It's amazing what you can find in some of the most unusual places, like in this case, an old discarded technical manual in a dumpster. But that was the trigger for a 30-year quest to finally tell the story of the forgotten ocean liner of the skies. It was the world's largest airliner, yet it never saw service, and only one was built and flown before the program was scrapped. Well, I've got an author I'd like you to meet who used that discarded manual as an inspiration to tell the real story behind why it was built and what happened next. Was it really the disaster we heard about, or was it just ahead of its time? Stick around, because you'll not only find out, you'll learn more about the book and the writing journey this author took to create it.
Welcome to a Book Finds You podcast. This week's guest is Alan Porter. Join us as he shares the inspiration behind his book, along with his writing process, routines, and challenges. And now, here's your host, best-selling author, Rob Jellis.
Today's guest, Alan J. Porter, writes about stuff and makes up stories, too. He's best known for his pop culture nonfiction work, but he's also written the occasional short story, novella, and comic book series. His upcoming book, Bristol Brabazon, The Ocean Liner of the Skies and Its Ongoing Legacy, takes to the air in mid-2025. Happy to have you with us, and welcome to the show, Alan.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here with you. I enjoyed the episodes of the show I've listened to soon. Having just moved back to Maryland after 15 years in Texas, it's nice to be back in part of the Maryland writers community and enjoying it.
Well, welcome back. I can hear that Texas accent coming out of you right now.
That's why it never goes away.
And by the way, I think this is interesting. Alan was teaching me a few things before we started, and one of them was the term novella, which was new to me. So tell everybody what a novella is.
Well, basically, it's a piece of fiction that's longer than a short story, but shorter than a novel. So hence novella.
See, that's why we listen to podcasts, folks, because we're always learning. Okay, I normally ask about how this book found you, but we kind of have a head start on that one with The Dumpster. But go ahead and give that story some breath. Tell me about how you found that.
Okay, so more than 30 years ago, I started my post-college career at British Aerospace in the southwest of England, working as a technical writer and then heading the technical documentation department. And I've always been interested in planes and stuff like that since I was a kid. Dream job at stuff, you know. My first piece of writing was writing a tech manual for Concorde. So that was pretty cool. And one day I was walking back from a meeting, and around the back of one of the big hangar there, I saw a tech manual sticking out of a dumpster. And as technical documentation was my department's responsibility, I had to go check it out and see what somebody had thrown away. And it was a servicing manual for the Bristol Brabazon, which, as you said, was a sort of a one-off, the world's largest airliner back in the late 40s, early 50s. Always been interested in the story of the airplane, because there was a big picture of it on my boss's office, and then what became my office, there was a big picture of it on the wall, but nobody really talked about it. I found this book in the dumpster, took it back to my department, made sure that we didn't have a copy in the archives, which we didn't, and then asked my boss and my boss's boss, what should I do with it? And we were busy going ahead with the new Airbus program. We were all eyes to the future at that point. Nobody had any interest in the past, and they were like, you can just hang on to it and keep it. Which I have. It's still sitting in my office. It's sitting in the bookcase right next to me. So for 30 years on and off, I was like, I've wanted to tell the story of this aeroplane, because everybody just writes it off as either a white elephant, or if you open, I've got a book called The Worst Aeroplanes in the World, and it's got an entry in there. Mm. And I felt it was a disservice was done to this beautiful, majestic aeroplane and the story behind it. So on and off, I've just wanted to write it. And a couple of years ago, when we moved house, I saw the manual again as we were emptying the boxes and thought, is it probably about time I wrote that story, and pitched it to a couple of publishers. And lo and behold, third one I pitched it to was like, yeah, let's go tell the stories. And that's what I've been doing the last couple of years, is researching and writing the story.
Outstanding. And you know, it's the poster child, Alan, for what we sort of this dream of mine of a book finds you, because We don't find it, it finds us. And your path is really interesting because it was part way through a dumpster that found you. But that's usually what happens, you know, and that's why sometimes with editors and things, when they're after an author, I know for my editors, I'm always sort of pushing them back, going, you can't push me into writing a book. I haven't found it yet. I just sent an email. It's been about 4 years, 5 years for me now, but I sent an email to my editor recently, said, found it, but it has to find you. You can't just decide I'm going to wake up tomorrow and write a book. It just doesn't work that way.
No, you're right. It does. I mean, I think this is my 40th book publishing credit of either books I've completely written on my own or been, contributed to. And you're right. The books that I've written on my own or one that I co-wrote with my wife, there's just always some moment when you think, that's it. We're going to go write that.
So tell me this, the book and the story about Howard Hughes and the big aircraft that he was putting a lot of dollars behind. Are you familiar with that story?
The Spruce Goose, yes.
Yes. Bigger, large, kind of compare it to what you're doing. I'm just curious. We're not talking about the same aircraft, though.
No, we're not talking about the same aircraft. The Brabazon was built totally in the UK. The Spruce Goose is slightly bigger in the fuselage, has a slightly smaller wingspan, but that was a seaplane. The Brabazon was at the time the largest land plane built. The Russians. Soviet during the Soviet era built some bigger stuff, but up until the mid-50s, it was the largest land plane built.
Okay, good. All right. And one other thing, and then I'm going to jump into your writing style. I'm very impressed with 40 book credits there. Congratulations. You're
Thank
leading
you.
the pack right now.
Okay. I didn't think it was a competition, but okay.
Oh, you got to get to know me. Everything's a competition with Rob Jollis, but it's, we all have walk with a limp, as they say. That's one of my limps. But I noticed that you wrote this book in memory to Brian Kent.
Yes.
Let's spend it just a moment or two and tell me about Brian Kent.
Brian Kemp is my father-in-law, my late father-in-law, who passed away last year before last. Oh my God, yeah. Just he worked in the aerospace industry in Bristol as well, Bristol in the south of England. That was the major employer. Everybody in my wife's family worked, bar as one sister, worked at some point in their life in the industry. Brian worked on the engine side. I say he was my father-in-law. He was always a big champion of everything that I did. And he, at the beginning of the project, he was very interested in it and tell me all sorts of stories. One of the fun things about working on the book is when we did our research trips to Bristol, you mentioned to anybody that you were working on a book about the Bristol Brabazon, and everybody had a story. Either, they had a member of the family on it, or they had older members of the family who remembered seeing it fly, or, one person who ended up in the book cycled out to watch the first flight as a 14-year-old boy on his bicycle, and then went on to a huge career in the aerospace industry. Everybody has stories about it. And Brian was always, as well as having stories and contacts within the industry, was always very, very supportive of all my writing. And he, I say, unfortunately, he passed away suddenly as we were in the middle of writing the book. So it was just seemed natural to dedicate the book to his memory.
Good. Well, and what a lovely thing to do because that book's going to be around for a while, and so we get to keep Brian around with us for a while. So that was a very nice touch. All right, let's talk about you and your writing style. Even with a book like this, I'm curious, do you kind of begin with the end in mind of where this story is going to end up? And we, of course, we know, historically where it ended up, but as a writer, where you were going to end up. Or did you just let that path kind of present itself as you went along?
I sort of let it present itself. What I wanted to do with this book was actually make the aeroplane a character with it. There has been a couple of other books about this project over the years, but they've been very technical. They're good and they're very detailed, but they're very much about how the plane was built. I wanted to know why the project came about in the first place, and then the changing social, cultural, political scene around it. But it's bad timing in history, building this mammoth piston engine plane just as jet airliners are coming along. I mean, the timing was like completely wrong for this project. So I wanted to sort of tell the story and make playing the central character. So yes, I knew what was going to happen at the end, clearly, because historically it's there in the, in the
Right.
historical record. But I wanted to sort of build a connection to this beautiful project as it was going along, and the people who worked on it and stuff like that. So my aim was really, like I said, because I do write fiction as well, my aim was to make the aircraft a character. And what really pleased me is when I have a copy editor I work with who is actually in the aviation industry as well. She edits a couple of the aviation magazines. And she actually emailed me when she got to the chapter where it got broken up. She said, I was literally crying when they broke. She said, they can't do that to our Brabazon. And I was like, okay, that worked.
That's right. That's a pat on the back for you. Your mission accomplished. You've got somebody to care about the character. That's fascinating to me. And I'm really glad you said you brought that out, because I like that ask that question from time to time. Because, and it's not that we're a slave to the finish, by the way. We all have a plan. Most of us have an outline, but I've never met a writer yet, a good one, that didn't say, oh, it expanded and contracted as I was going along. Because we start getting inspired when we're writing. We start finding things when we're writing that we didn't know were there. But it's interesting, a book like this that has a historical beginning, middle, and end, still you're kind of trying to shape the end, separate from history towards the character. Anyway, I hope people are listening to that, because there's no right or wrong way, but but I like having an end in mind. I'm not saying it's the right way. I'm just saying I always kind of queue up with the people that see it that way. Not that I haven't changed my endings, but it gets.
I'm with you on that. When I write fiction, I usually like to have the ending in mind, but it isn't always the ending. Characters will take you in a completely different thing that you never thought of when you're in the middle of a story or whatever. And the interesting thing with this one you said about outlining, obviously with my non-fiction work, I very much outline the book before I start writing. But even with this one, there was probably about halfway through, I'm like, no, chapters are in the wrong order. I've got to move this piece to here and this piece to there. So even with that, yes, even though I do outline nonfiction work very, very carefully to start with, I'm still open to moving those pieces of the jigsaw around to tell a better story.
Yeah. How long is a typical outline for you?
It's probably just a couple of pages. It's mainly chapter headings of this is what I want to do in each chapter. With fiction, it's usually story beats. It can, again, with writing comics, which is a whole other, probably a whole other discussion, but coming from writing comics, the way you start with a 22-page comic is that outline is 22, literally 22 bullet points. What do I want to happen on page one? What do I want to happen on page two? Blah, 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 blah. And as I said, I come from a technical writing background as well, where again, you're outlining in very
Right.
distinct steps. So it's sort of just my writing DNA is to outline. But the more I've got into writing fiction, I've also realized that I need to be able to, like you said, move the pieces around and make changes.
Yeah. Yeah, I am from my angle, and I write pretty much just business books, but I can actually get the sense of the health of a chapter through the outline, because I'll do a page per chapter, and it's just about, maybe 12 or 15 bullet points. Tell that story, like that analogy, put this process in. But when I see two bullets, I'm getting a visual look at this might not be a chapter. Maybe this is just something that belongs and in, tacked into another chapter. When I see 40 bullets, I'm seeing maybe I've got a couple of chapters here. And it's not a perfect science, but I like getting that big look at the, the big picture of the book.
I mean, my current nonfiction project that I just started working on, I only got the contract in December, so I'm only 2 months into it, and I've already taken two chapters and merged them together, because when I started it, and it's like, oh, yeah, that's not going to be enough for a chapter, and I need to move, what I thought was going to be the second chapter is now the first, and so forth. So
Yeah. Been there. Been there. All right. Let's talk about your writing routine, Mr. 40 Books and counting. at this point, you probably have a pretty good system down. So what does it look like? I talk to some people that, have to do it a certain time each day. Talk to others that are just looking for word counts per week and kind of give themselves some grace. What does it look like for you?
I think it's I usually have several different projects on the go at once, so it may from the outside seem a bit chaotic, but generally I write in the evenings. because I it used to be, you know, when I had the full-time day job, I'm now semi-retired, but when I had a full-time day job, it was like, you know, that's what I would do was write in the evenings after dinner. So that sort of carried on. But I also do a lot of I have used to do a lot of business travel, not so much these days. So I sort of taught myself to write wherever I am, and when the opportunity arises. So like if I'm sat in a airport for with a 3 hour layover, I've got the iPad out and I'm working, I'm writing. So you know, if I'm in a hotel room, there's only so many episodes of, you know, American Pickers you can watch. So, you know, now when I'm in a hotel, I don't turn the TV on. I either get up early in the morning before I go to meetings and write, or I write in the evening. So it's a little all over the place. It's not as disciplined as maybe it should be, but I get stuff done.
Yeah, that's the
So,
key. That's the key. We share that, Alan. I am got about 3 million in the air as a guy who delivers workshops and seminars based on my books. But the funny thing for me is I wrote at least two books in the air. I mean, 100% in the air. But when my business travel went down, I actually had a little challenge of trying to figure out a new routine because I like that white noise and leave me alone in my aisle so well. That I was trying to figure out, okay, well, now what do I do? Do you have a, when you're at home, do you have a kind of a favorite room to write in or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sat in my office now and you can probably see all my books and stuff behind me. Yeah, you know, I come in my office and shut the door, and luckily my wife's a writer too. She's really just starting her writing career, but she has her own office on the other side of the apartment. So, you know, we both sort of disappear to our offices and work away separately. So in fact, this afternoon we just spent 4 hours sitting next to each other, co-working on a project. So, like I said, we have these sort of outlines, if you like, of what we should be doing, but we're very flexible about what we need to do to just get the work done. So, yeah. I
Yeah.
mean, you said about the white noise. When I'm writing fiction, particularly when I'm writing dialogue, I found I can't write dialogue when I'm at home, which is weird. When I need to write dialogue, particularly when I was doing a lot of comic scripting and the writing dialogues for comics, I would go to somewhere with a coffee shop or a coffee shop in the bookstore or somewhere where there was white noise of people talking. And then I can write dialogue if there's white noise of people talking. I'm not necessarily listening to their conversations. It's just that buzz of voices helps me get the voices going in my head. It's really weird. But if I'm doing, you know, stuff that doesn't involve dialogue, then yeah, I'm in my room and tend to be quiet. I don't have music or anything on. I just sit here and write.
Yeah, I'll pop off to the library now and then. One, I'm not getting binged by the internet and my emails. And two, to your point, there's almost a low hum of noise there, very low. And I do find that's conducive to writing. But the point that Alan and I are trying to make right now is it's different for everybody, and you got to pay attention because you're looking for that environment. We want, you know, we want to get as much on our side as possible as we dive into this thing. So an outline, a good place to write, an end in mind. These are things that writers need to think about. Let's talk about some of the challenges that you run up against. What's some of the, you know, sometimes things come easy, sometimes they don't. What are some challenges that you run into as a writer?
Well, that's a really good question. I guess, you know, sometimes I do get stuck, like we all do. I don't believe there's such a thing as writer's block. I'll go off my rant on that if you like.
Oh, no, I really was taking a sip of tea. I love to hear this rant because that's what holds a lot of people back. So I hear hope in what you just said. So let's park ourselves there for a moment. Go ahead. You've got the floor.
Okay, because whenever I do conventions or conferences and you know you do the panels and stuff and somebody says, well, what about writer's block? Yeah, there is no such thing as writer's block. You may get stuck on a story or you may get stuck on a piece of work you're working on, but you can always go and do something. Imagine you were, I don't know, having a open heart surgery and the surgeon came in and said, sorry, I can't operate this afternoon, I've got surgeon's block. Or you know, your sink's leaking, sorry, the plumber's like, I can't come in this afternoon, I've got plumber's block. You know, it's ridiculous. No other profession says they can't work because they've got whatever their profession is block. There is no such thing as writer's block. Yes, we get stuck. Go do something else. Write something else. That's why I usually have three projects on the go at once. You know, I mean, currently I've got a nonfiction book, a novel, and a short story on the go. And if I get if I'm stuck on one, I'll pull up one of the other ones and I start writing that. And then quite often while I'm working on that, I'll realize what the resolution to the other problem is. So, or go for a walk, or go do something different and disengage your mind from the problem, and you'll probably find the problem solves itself. So yeah, I whenever anybody says writer's block, I gets my back up. Sorry.
No, that
But
was extremely well done, by the way. I mean, that should provide hope to some people who are listening. And I was actually just taking some notes on that because I think it's smart. I think it's I refer to myself as being what I call OCD-ish. Okay. And I'm no disrespect to those who have OCD. It's a terrible thing when you've got it. I don't, or if I do, I'm very low on the scale. But I like to think I make it work for me. And so there are certain things like what you just said. Of course, the brain every now and then goes, I don't really feel like writing today. So I've got writer's block. Yeah. And when we give in to those types of noises, the noises get louder the next day. I mean, it works. Let's try it again. So I haven't articulated it your way, but I like telling myself, oh, I'm sorry. That's not going to work right now. Yeah, you may, you have, Rob, I'm giving you permission to sit there and stare at that keyboard. But you're not getting up and you're not moving on and you're not playing solitaire. You're just going to stay put for a little bit. Funny how ideas start coming back into our head. So, yeah, I like that.
Oh, just, open a blank document and just write words. It doesn't have to be your current projects. I mean, I also have this when people say, oh, you have to write every day. Yes, I write every day, but I don't write every day on my. I think that puts a strain on people to think they have to write every day on their current project.
Yeah.
Oh, you've got to work on your novel every day. No, write, yeah, write every day because writing's a muscle. We need to keep it in tune. But, that could be, I don't know, writing a couple of, Instagram posts, or, just writing a paragraph of, an idea down for a short story while you're working on a novel. It could be. Yes, I like to write something every day. I have to write every day. But I'm not writing on my big project every day. And I don't feel I'm putting myself under stress by doing that. And, and then when my brain is in that right, I can sit down for a few hours and, or an evening and knock out stuff on the big project, whatever it is, knowing that I've, the day before I might have just done, a couple of social media posts, but I wrote. So, keeping that muscle going. And you asked about challenges. I think biggest challenges is, particularly doing the nonfiction stuff, is around research. It's very interesting. One of the first, I think my second book was a book about the Beatles. And it turned out that the four Beatles themselves are the worst witnesses to their own life, because they sort of got told things and then that were wrong, and they repeat back their own mythology as if it happened to them. But when you actually do the research and go to the primary sources, that's not the case. And
An example of that, Alan. Just cherry pick one.
John Lennon always gets the age he was when his mother was killed wrong in every interview. You think that would be seared into his brain, but he's always gets that wrong. The myth that this about the song that Paul McCartney sang or played for John when they've done the day they first met, that song had n never been released in the UK at that point. And if you actually when I actually got to talk to other members of John's band, who schoolboy band, who were there, some of them don't even remember Paul playing anything. But if you watch like the Beatles anthology, Paul tells the story because he's heard it back so many times.
Interesting.
So, doing the research, like my current projects is around a particular sort of movie and movie adaptations. And there's a myth about that, about a member of the cast getting up, who was playing dead, getting up and walking off while the cameras were still turning, even though they were meant to be a dead, dead on set. If you actually watch the footage and the behind the scene footage, he did not do that. That was actually on another production by the same team, but it got moved to this, the story got moved to this production. And I wrote something about it in one of my newsletters. And I even got an email from somebody saying, but I've got a letter that proves. And it's like, yeah, but if you watch the footage, it didn't happen. So yeah,
Wow.
research is the big thing, is how do you actually dig in and where do you decide to draw the line in terms of what's a fact, or, what's supported by the primary evidence against the what that other people think happened. And sometimes you just can't. Sometimes you just have to present, here's the three or four alternative scenarios you figure out. And we had a bit of that on the Brabazon book as well, where you've got to dig in and try and find things as to what actually happened, as opposed to general consensus or mythology or whatever. Yeah, so the research is all, it's fun. I love doing the research. Sometimes I love doing research way too much, which is why I haven't finished my novel yet, because I'm spending way too much time researching it. But sometimes you really have to sort of put the brakes on and decide where you're going to draw a line about around the research.
Yeah. I keep a, sometimes I give it to new writers and I should have it in front of me, but I don't. But it's this little, I don't know if it's a poem, but it's basically gets people moving. And it says, thinking about writing is not writing. Planning to write is not writing. Researching to write is not writing. About four more, Alan. And then writing is writing.
Yeah.
And, so, and again, I also studied one time about procrastination. I always assumed when you heard the word procrastination, it meant somebody was being lazy. That's not accurate. It actually means you're just prioritizing things in different places, typically the things that we like to do in front of the things that we really should be doing. But at the end of the day, we're exhausted. We worked all day and we got a lot accomplished, just not what we planned on accomplishing. And I think that happens with writers and maybe in the research. It's an area we can hang around in. You're getting something done, but I don't see any words going down on that manuscript right now.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, when people ask me what does it take to write a book, I say you put your bum in the chair, your hands on the keyboard, and start typing.
Right. Like my dad used to say, put one foot in front of the other. You put
Yeah.
one word in front of the other. That's
Yep.
about what it takes. Let's talk about the publishing and marketing side. You've got 40 books. Give me the spread there. Self-published, hybrid published, conventional published, a little of some. What are we
A
looking at?
combination of all of the above. First book was traditional published, second book was self-published. That's actually the only one I've completely self-published so far. The rest have been either small different sizes of press, from friends small press to anthologies to traditional publishers. But the Brabazon book is a specialist aviation publisher. The next one that's coming out is more of an academic publisher. So yeah, a whole variety. Not none of the big five, four, however many it's down to now. But generally, it tends to be sort of specialist publishers, specialist niche publishers,
Yeah.
but traditional publishing sort of type deals. Yeah.
Yeah, I come from the conventional side, but I'm getting pushed right now in business to create a lead magnet. And so I may very well go self-published on an ebook just to basically utilize it as a lead magnet, a giveaway. I'm learning that world as we speak right now.
Yeah, my wife and I are circling back on potentially self-publishing her debut novel. So we're doing a lot of
Yeah.
digging and researching that area at the moment.
Hearing a lot of good things about Ingram Sparks, as one, but not promoting them, just letting you know that for me, I haven't heard a whole lot of negative voices on that one. Okay, do you have an agent?
No, I've had a couple in the past, but everything I've sold myself. So,
Yeah, isn't that funny? They tend to come around after we've sold them. I'm the same way. And I've always told people to come up and tell me if you agree with this, that I think finding an agent is harder than finding a publisher.
Much so. Yeah, I think it's harder than finding a wife, to be honest, finding a good one. Yeah, no, I've, like I said, I've had two in the past, but they didn't necessarily do anything. I have another Beatles book idea that I'm sort of playing around with. I think when the time comes to take that one out, I might look for an agent. If I ever finish my novel, I might look for an agent for that, because it's not an area that I've really had much experience in. But I found that the best way really is just to network and get to know editors and publishers, and particularly, you start with the smaller ones, and that tends to lead, you build a portfolio and that leads to another one. Or, if you've got a particular niche, finding out who the niche publisher is, go to conventions, go to conferences and get to know them.
Home
That's
run, a huge point you just made, Alan, because people will tell you, well, wait a minute, listen, this Rob and Alan are talking about this, but they don't understand that, and my goodness, Simon and Schuster won't take my manuscript without an agent. Not true. They certainly won't take it as an orphan manuscript, but if you know an author within Simon and Schuster, they'll take it. They're absolutely allowed, and the editor wants them to bring in those manuscripts. They're just trying to, they're getting thousands of submissions, and this is their way of trying to, you know, put at least vet out some of the manuscripts coming in. But to your point, Alan, I don't think people give it enough credit of how important that network word you just used is. So if we build ourselves a good network, there's really no publisher we can't approach.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've had meetings in some of the big publishers in New York because of contacts I've made. It's not necessarily got a deal out of them yet, but I got one of my comics deals because the editor I knew at one place moved to a new publisher, and you know, I sort of went with him. So
Well, that's, you know, that's the real world here. It just is. And so fear not, everyone. If you're really getting beaten up looking for those agents, network a little bit harder, and you might very well be able to find somebody that'll help that get that book into the right publisher's hands. All right, last question for you, Alan. Let's say I'm listening to this show right now, and I've had the dream. And I know you bump into a lot of people who say, oh, I've always wanted to write a book. So we don't have to go too far to find somebody who feels that way. What would be one or two things you'd tell them to maybe boost them up a little bit and keep them in the right direction?
I think one of the things I always tell people, it's great. One of the questions I ask them is, what's your book about? Mm-hmm. And they invariably start telling me the plot or about a character. And I'm like, no, what's it about? What's the theme? What's the central idea? If you don't have a central idea, you don't have a book. Mm-hmm. So go away and think about what's the, you know, tell me what your favorite book is and what the central idea or the central theme of that book is.
Right.
Start right. thinking in those terms, you know, go tell me your favorite movie. Tell me what the central theme is. What's what they call in screenwriting, the governing principle, the governing idea. If you can start thinking in those terms, then you've got a step to actually start writing a book, because it has to be about something and not character A moves from point A to, you know, point X to point Y, or, you know, and gets his magic sword. That's a plot. I want to know what it's about. You know, is it about brothers? Is it about good versus evil? Is it about changing times? Is it, you know, the Brabazon book about an aeroplane, that was actually really about changing technology and culture. That's what that book was really about, and the impact of changing technology and culture. But on the surface, it's not. It's a book about a big aeroplane, but it was about changing. So for me, my first question is always, what's it about?
Yeah. And for me, and you've learned this from being on the show, I like to hear what the hook is.
Yeah.
I want to hear why I'd be excited about this. And the same thing I get, two people are going down a country road and they find a car. No. I don't really don't want to really hear the plot line. Why would I want to read this?
Yeah.
And I knew I was dealing with a really good author before I met you, because you had no problem with that at all. Immediately, it's like, well, how about I was climbing through a dumpster with them? Like, now you're hooking me. I want to hear about this. I think we got to have a sense of the big picture. And I think that's well said, Alan. All right, my friend, how do people get a hold of you?
Through my website. It's my website is alanjporter.com. And I also have a weekly free newsletter if you want to just keep up with sort of slice of life stuff, plus updates on my writing projects. You can sign up for that at alanjporter.substack.com.
Got it.
It's free and comes out every Friday if I'm on time. Except myself.
Okay. Well, outstanding. I'm going to sign up for that, by the way. So we'll talk about that when we get off the air here. I want to thank you for coming in. Every time you see me turn to the side and start writing, consider that a success, because that means I'm hearing something that I, you know, it's said a different way, and I need to capture that. I need to remember that. I did that at least three times, and you've actually inspired me to write a blog about one of them. I'll tell you about that also. Well, I'll tell you about it now. I liked your vision and how you put words behind writer's block. I think you're right. I think we give this, it's like this mythical monster we're giving all this credit to, and it's all air. It doesn't belong there. I just think that's a really important point amongst many that you made. In any case, thank you so much for being on, Alan. Really enjoyed getting to know you and hearing about your books.
Thank you. Absolute pleasure.
You bet. Well, we'll do it again as well as we can next time, everybody. Until then, stay safe.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's guest author, we'd love you to rate, review, and share this episode with others. If you'd like more information on today's guest or the Maryland Writers Association, please visit our website at marylandwriters.org. You can also find out about the history of the Maryland Writers Association by listening to our first podcast, Episode 0.